I know you're out there. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
The Chris Ann Hall Show.
Any varmint that crosses that lady's path has met its match.
Come on!
Rise and shine, liberty-loving patriots. Welcome to the Chris Ann Hall Show. Chris Ann Hall here, KRISANNEHALL.com. I am so happy to be here, so happy to profess liberty over security, principle over party, and truth over your favorite personality. And, you know, you guys know how I do this. I search the news, I find contemporary issues, turn them into constitutional training sessions, and I'm having a problem, to be totally honest with you. I am searching and searching and searching the internet for something that I can turn into a constitutional training session that we haven't been talking about for the last 3 weeks. And the crazy thing is, there is how does the media do anything? They have been talking about the same three things for months now. How do they keep our attention like that? I can't imagine limiting the topic of my shows Monday through Friday and Sunday to three particular subject matters for 2 months. That is insanity. I mean, I can't do that anymore. And so what I'd like to do is just, let's just sit down and have a little fireside chat tonight. What do you think? Let's just take this downtime. Congress isn't in session, so thank God they're not really doing anything to destroy the country right now. Their absence is enough in when they're in office. I mean, they're obviously never doing their job when they're there, and so when they're gone, we really don't see much difference, except they're not creating new problems for us. And so I'm sure you've had enough presidential debate conversation, and we all know what the problems are. So we've got riots coming up again in Ferguson, Missouri, on the anniversary. We've got Obama crying out race, race, race again while he's on vacation at Martha's Vineyard. You know, I mean, this is the same old story playing over and over and over again. So let's just take a little fireside chat and go over some fundamental issues. We'll just have a little training session, a little reminder in our boot camp on how things to work. And I'd like to start off with a brief and simple primer about the structure of our republic according to our founders. Not according to the Supreme Court of the United States and not according to the federal supremacists. You know, had a very interesting Twitter conversation today with a conservative, someone who calls themselves a conservative, a Rick Perry follower, worshiper. And, you know, I said, look, I think that there are some real issues here, that a governor shouldn't stand up and say, well, you know, this is the law, we just have to follow the law. And he was talking about conceal and carry permits. And, we make people have driver's licenses to have the privilege to ride on our roads. And the conceal and carry permits are the same way. It's a privilege to carry a gun in the state of Texas. And I simply said, that's not true. The right to keep and bear arms is not a privilege. It is a right. And that's something that we should be calling out people when they make these mistakes. Now, Rick Perry says he wants to be the Second Amendment guy, and he wants to be that guy that has that A rating on gun issues. Well, we need to correct him when he's wrong. No, possessing a gun is not a privilege. It is an inherent right, an inalienable right. I don't need your gun permit, because I have the right to defend myself without the government Here's the crazy thing about this. You see, government has no rights. Governments are a collective of individual rights. And if Rick Perry believes that I do not have the individual right to carry a firearm, then that means that the government doesn't have the power to legislate over that. You see, government only has the power to legislate over things that I have the individual right to do. And if I don't have the individual right to do something, I can't delegate that power to the government to legislate me over it. And so it creates this whole paradox. So we're having this conversation. And I said, look, you can't liken conceal and carry permits to driver's licenses. And this person said, well, look, this is just the law, and the governor has to submit to the law. I said, well, that's very interesting, because it was the law that Rosa Parks had to sit in the back of the bus. Should we just simply champion the governor that said, no, I'm sorry, Miss Parks, you're going to have to sit in the back of the bus until we can get the legislatures to do something different? What kind of a governor is that? A governor who takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, takes an oath to support the liberties and the rights of the people. That's what that oath means. Why can't the governor say, no, that law violates my oath to defend your liberty, and I will not allow that law to be enforced? We're not asking governors to be dictators. Dictators take rights from people. We're asking them to be a patriot and protect rights and liberties. He says, well, you just don't understand the power of the governor. No, I understand the power of the governor. I understand his obligation to his oath as well. And then the conversation came up about protecting the borders. Well, the governor doesn't have any right to overturn the legislators' laws, just like he doesn't have any right to do anything about the borders. Really? See, this is really just enlightening to me, this real fundamental problem with our self-proclaimed conservatives in understanding the proper role of government. Why we have government, what it's there for, how it's supposed to operate, and the power play between the states and the feds. You see, I simply said, well, that's ridiculous, because if the states aren't doing their job, then it's up to... I'm sorry, if the feds are not doing their jobs, then it's up to the states to do it for them. And then my Twitter conversation ended, because this person scoffed me and said, you obviously are no constitutional expert. You don't understand that the states don't have any authority over what's been delegated to the federal government. Really? Really? So we're missing some, there's some serious disconnect here, and I think we need to just talk about these things, because I want you to be just excessively armed and capable to defeating these types of federal supremacist ideas. Think about this. The proposition is this: that certain powers were delegated to the federal government, which means they're off limits to everybody else. So in the case of the borders, we've delegated that power to the federal government. I'm not quite sure the article and the section in the clause where we delegate border protection, okay? But we'll just say, all right, we'll lump that in with, you know, national security, if you want. I'm not even sure where I find that actually either, but we'll see. Okay, common defense. All right, so common defense. We'll put that in the common defense clause. So what this person is assuming is that because this power has been delegated to the federal government, this common defense power, and because they're refusing to do it, our framers created a system where when the federal government refuses to do what they've been delegated to do, then that function goes unperformed. That means if the federal government doesn't want to protect the United States from foreign invasion, then we all just have to sit around and be invaded. The idea is that if the federal government's been delegated a power, nobody else can do that. And so there's a void there. If they don't do it, then a void exists, and we must just simply sit around and accept our lumps. Do we really think now? I know the progressives think our framers were stupid and a bunch of rich guys who were greedy and slave owners and all that stuff. But this person is a conservative who claims to understand the Constitution, which I'm sure would admit they have a profound respect for the framers. Do we actually believe that they were so stupid that they would create a system with such an obvious void? Surely not. Surely not. But the interesting thing is the conversation ended there. I mean, I'm simply having a discussion here. I say, what is your background and your understanding on this? On the states can't fill the void when the feds don't do their job. And as I say, crickets, nothing. What is that? So I want you to be prepared to handle these kind of conversations, because I can't be the only one who is subject to this. And so I want to give a little primer on the structure of our republic, according to our framers. Understanding James Madison, the father of our Constitution, said that powers are delegated to the federal government are few and defined. And he lists them in Federalist 45 as external objects. That's founder's way of talking about foreign affairs. And then he lists them as war, peace, negotiations, and foreign commerce. He also explains that the General Welfare Clause does not grant the government the power to do generally whatever they want. It simply describes the purpose in delegating those few powers listed, to operate for the general welfare of all the states in the Union. In other words, our framers believed in and intended for a limited government. A very limited government. Madison says at the convention, I, sir, have always conceived, and I believe those who proposed the Constitution conceived, and I still more fully known and more material to observe, that those who ratified the Constitution conceived, that this is not an indefinite government, but a limited government. And this is what we need to understand. This proper placement of power.
Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
So yes, the federal government was delegated power. Delegated. We didn't surrender power to the federal government. We delegated power to the federal government. Look up that word delegate in the dictionary. It's a transfer of power. To authorize someone to represent those who are delegating. It's an entrusting someone with a task or a responsibility. And you entrust someone typically who is less senior than yourself. You don't delegate power to someone who is superior to you. That doesn't make any sense. No, you delegate power to an inferior authority to do a job for you. It is a temporary transfer. It is not a permanent surrender. And so we are to understand that we were delegating power to the federal government. And by the same token, Congress itself was to have limited and a limited and strictly defined role. Congress was not established to become the federal government, but to control it on behalf of the people. That's the reason why Congress holds the most influence and control through the checks and balances established through the powers of impeachment, congressional oversight, and the power of the purse. Congress, we do not, let's just start off here. We do not have three co-equal branches of government. we have three branches of government who have been vested with varying degrees of power. Congress, vested with the greatest amount of power, because they were to be the checks and balances established through powers of impeachment, congressional oversight, and through the funding and defunding. James Madison said to Jefferson in 1787, "In the American Constitution, the general authority will be derived entirely from subordinate authorities. The Senate will represent the states in their political capacity, and the other house will represent the people of the states in their individual capacity." So in understanding how Congress is supposed to run, we need to understand that the Senate was established to represent the states in the federal government. That's why each state is allotted the same number of senators. That's why Article 5 says that each senator will have equal suffrage in the Senate. And so all of this was to ensure equal representation and an equal control for all the states. And the Senate's primary job description was to protect the states from federal encroachment and to ensure each state's sovereignty. They were the defenders of, or are supposed to be, the defenders of the 10th Amendment. That's a good job description for them. Tinchcock, in a document that he wrote called An American Citizen in 1788, said, "The president bears no resemblance to a king. So we shall see the Senate have no similitude to nobles. First, then, not being hereditary, their collective knowledge, wisdom, and virtue are not precarious. For by these qualities alone are they to obtain their offices. And they will have none of the peculiar follies and vices of those men who possess power, merely because their fathers held it before them. For they will be educated, under equal advantages with equal prospects, among and on a footing with the other sons of a free people." The Senate's not supposed to be an aristocracy. They're supposed to be elected based on their merits, on their moral standing, and on their reputations in society. The House was designed to be the representatives of the people. That's why there are more House members than Senate, that better reflect the population of each people of the people in each state. The House's primary job description was to be the guardians of the people's liberty so that the people can maintain the rights guaranteed by the Constitution. Defenders of the Ninth Amendment would be a good job description for our founders, or for our House as attended by the founders. Tinchcock also says in 1788, "Each member of this truly popular assembly, the House of Representatives, will be chosen by about 6,000 electors, by the poor as well as the rich. No decayed and venal borough will have an unjust share in their determinations. No old sarum will send thither a representative by the voice of a single elector. As we shall have no royal ministries to purchase votes, so we shall have no votes for sale. For the suffrages of 6,000 enlightened and independent freemen are above all price." Wow. Wouldn't it be nice if our congressmen were actually representatives of the people and their votes were above all price? Well, we can do it when we have the proper perspective on government, its role, and its power.
Chris Ann Hall Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
Well, here we are today with a Senate that looks more like a protector of the federal government and a representative of the federal government rather than the defenders of the states, and a House that feels its primary role is to protect national security instead of the rights and liberties of the people. Placing security over liberty seems to be a common affliction of our Congress. You just ask them. Patrick Henry made it perfectly clear that without liberty, life was not even worth living. And Benjamin Franklin rightly declared that if security was placed above liberty, we would lose them both. So what do we do when they do more than they're supposed to do? When they refuse to follow the limitations of the Constitution? Well, our framers gave us these guidelines. In Federalist Papers 33, it says if the federal government should overpass the just bounds of its authority and make a tyrannical use of its powers, the people, whose creature it is, must appeal to the standard they have formed and take such measures as to redress the injury done to the Constitution. But it will not follow that acts of the large society, which are not pursuant to its constitutional powers, but which are invasions of the residuary authorities of the smaller societies, will become the supreme law of the land. He's simply saying, look, they can't be the supreme law of the land if they don't follow the Constitution. Federalist Papers 33, Matt Hamilton says, these will be merely acts of usurpation and will deserve to be treated as such. Why? Because the Supremacy Clause says that if they are contrary to the Constitution, they cannot be valid. This is a fundamental principle of state nullification. And if Congress understood their proper role, they would know that when the federal government creates unjust and unconstitutional laws, it's their job to protect the people from it and declare the sovereignty of the people over the powers delegated to the federal government. If they really understood their oath to the Constitution and what their obligations really are, they would be nullifying Obamacare, UN treaties, and the myriad of unconstitutional executive orders spewed out by this current and past administrations. But our Congress does not understand their power. Or perhaps they do understand their power. It's the people who do not understand the limited nature of Congress. And the current lack of understanding of the proper relationship between the states and its federal government, as well as the neglect of the proper role of our congressional employees, is leading directly to the destruction of our Constitution. And so what we need to know and what we need to do is to get Congress to do their job. Now, as we mentioned before, oversight is one of Congress's job. And congressional oversight refers to the review, monitoring, and supervision of federal agencies, programs, activities, and policy implementation. Congressional oversight is, quote, a derived power, and even the congressional research refers to it as an integral part of the American system of checks and balances. Now, our framers spent a whole lot of time discussing separation of powers and believed that separation was essential to the protection of liberty. Our founders believed that a certain amount of blending of these departments for checks and balances was necessary to prevent one branch from stealing power over the other. Federalist Papers 47, Madison talks about this. Now, Madison is quoting Montesquieu in 47. And Madison relates that there can be no liberty where the legislative and executive powers are united in the same person or body of magistrates, nor if the power of judging be not separate from the legislative and the executive powers. Madison simply reasons that the departments are not intended to be so separate that they have no partial agency in or no control over each other. See, the philosopher he's referring to, Montesquieu, was concerned with the whole part, the whole power of one department exercised in the hands of another department. Madison assures the constitutional critics that the current Constitution provides for safeguards against that encroachment and the abuses of liberty. He demonstrates this principle of checks and balances by pointing out the very existence of them in the several state constitutions that existed at the time of the writing of the Constitution. He points out that nearly all of the constitutions blend these powers, not for the purpose of stealing and usurping, but for the purpose of partial agency and control. For example, the Senate, which is the branch of legislation, which is a branch of the legislative department, is also the judicial tribunal for trial of impeachments. Finally, in response to the proponents of absolute separation, Madison explains that the very cause for liberty for which they fight is only obtained through proper blending of power to achieve control and oversight. Oversight, an essential check and balance. And in light of the founder's perspective and the truth behind separation of powers and each branch's responsibility to check the power of the other to maintain oversight, We have to ask, where is our current congressional oversight, even within its own branch? We see statement after statement of how appalled or outraged our senators are at the gross display of authority by the president. This Iran deal is a great controversy, right? But you can't have a deal outside of a treaty. The only deals you can have are ones that are treaties that are ratified by two-thirds of the Senate. So why is the Senate so upset about this instead of simply proclaiming, as our framers would expect them to, that this is not any law at all? It is not made in pursuant to the Constitution. It is not done under the proper provisions of limited government, and therefore it is no law. So don't worry about it. We'll just send Iran a letter saying, I'm sorry, our president's done something he's not allowed to do. The Secretary of War did that on behalf of Abraham Lincoln when he made a deal that was outside of congressional oversight. And why is it that Congress and the House of Representatives can complain so much about amnesty and all these executive orders that override the Constitution when they have the power to defund all of that stuff? Congress needs to be reminded that their job in congressional oversight is to improve the operation of government according to the Constitution, to evaluate programs and their performance, to detect and prevent poor administration, waste, abuse, arbitrary and capricious behavior, or illegal or unconstitutional conduct, to protect civil liberties and rights, to inform the general public, and ensure that executive policies reflect the public interest. This is crazy. Congress is supposed to do their job, and they work for us. So why isn't it that we're making them do this? Well, you know, the next branch of government vested with power is the president. And yet, we don't understand, and Congress refuses to hold the president to his limited and defined power. But our presidents, yes, that's plural, have exercised more power than kings. As a matter of fact, the last British king to issue an executive order, like our executive orders are issued today, was James II in 1688. That action was a catalyst to a revolution in Great Britain called the Glorious Revolution and brought the British people and the founders of our Union a very important liberty charter called the English Bill of Rights. And what was James II doing? The English Bill of Rights asserts that James II was completely destroying liberty by writing law, overturning law, and setting aside law when that power was reserved to the legislative branch alone. The king was violating separation of powers and stealing power from the legislative body. And in 1688, that was grounds for war. Yet in today's Congress, they're just going to sue the president. Or just maybe not sue, just sit and complain, right? What will our Congress do when these courts rule based on precedent, not the Constitution, that the president is operating under proper executive authority? Because after all, that's what, you know, we've been doing. And in our conservative circles, we actually believe that our framers created a president who is much like a king. Yet, in 1688, a people with no internet, no CNN, no MSNBC, no Fox News, no PBS, no History Channel, no public education, knew that when the executive branch stole power from the legislative branch, that this was the complete destruction of liberty. And today, we literally do nothing. And I believe it's because we're confused, even in our conservative circles, what kind of government that we have. We do not have a democracy. We have a constitutional republic. We have a constitutional republic where the government is limited by the Constitution, by its specific enumerations of power. where the remainder of the powers not delegated are reserved to the states. And if the federal government fails to do what it's been delegated to do, remember that definition of delegate, right? An authorization to represent the states. An entrusting of a task or responsibility to one who is less senior than itself. The states entrusted the federal government with certain powers. And when they fail to do that, it is the obligation of the states to perform that function for the people. Because after all, when you get down to the bottom line, it's the people who have delegated power to the states who have delegated to the power to the federal government, and it's the government that represents the people as a whole. And so we have to be able to use government as our representative, and if they fail to do that, then we're stuck doing it ourselves. That whole idea that if Governor Perry, if the federal government doesn't protect the borders, and Governor Perry is not able to, does that trickle down to the people as well? That if Governor Perry refuses to protect the borders and the federal government refuses to protect the borders, then that means the people are unable to protect themselves? We've got to get back to this proper understanding of how things are supposed to work.
Don't censor my voice. Hate me if you won't, or love me if you can. If the truth is what you want, then you found your man. I ain't backing down, I ain't backing up. If you think like I think, then crack it on up.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my
Chris Ann Hall Show. She's Liberty's lobbyist.
Now look, as I said, we're even confused in our conservative circles about this whole government thing. We believe that presidents can create deals outside of Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2 of the Constitution, that somehow the Senate is not necessary to make deals. And even in our conservative circles, you have people, I'm telling you, in the National Forum on respected conservative shows, claiming that the president has enormous power. I want you to listen to this interview that Megyn Kelly conducts on Fox, on her show, with their self-proclaimed constitutional experts. And you might get an idea of how confused we are in our conservative circles about the proper role of the federal government and the limited nature of the power delegated to the president.
Well, look, we've had a lot of people talking about, Republicans have been talking about, president is a king, the president thinks he's a monarch, the president thinks he's an emperor. If you look at the way our framers and our founders embedded the presidency into our civic culture, the president in many ways has more power than a monarch in a parliamentary society. Our president has enormous authority. He has, in the nuclear era, the power to destroy the whole world. That is how much authority and how much power our system puts on the president. The check on the president is twofold. One, what can the Congress do to him? But two, what does he as a man, what is his integrity and how is he bound to tradition and to everything else? If he doesn't care about that second part, there's very little to constrain the man.
That's right. That's right.
No, that's not right. But how can we expect the general public of our conservative people who get a lot of their information from Fox News to understand that the president doesn't have the power that he's exercising when you have the beloved Megyn Kelly right there saying, yes, that's right. No, that's wrong. Absolutely wrong. And look, We're never going to get a hold of this thing until we realize that there's a proper structure of power. When we have Supreme Court justices like Ginsburg did in 2012 on Al Hayat TV in Egypt being interviewed and saying that the Constitution of the United States is not a document that should be modeled throughout the world, complaining that it's over 200 years old and therefore is outdated, antiquated, written by a bunch of men who hated minorities and women. These are the things that she said. This woman who took an oath to bear allegiance to the Constitution of the United States is now cutting it down, denigrating it on international television. How do we allow that to happen? Because even in our conservative circles, we do not understand the proper role of government. And we don't understand that Justice Ginsburg should be impeached for that. She should have been impeached in 2012. It's 2015. I can't imagine what she's done in the last 3 years to further add to the articles of impeachment. I'm sure she hasn't corrected her behavior, her aggressive attack on the liberties of the people. The Constitution itself violates her oath. But what are we going to do? We've got to get educated ourselves. And that's why we got to have these little chats, right? While everybody's distracted by the bread and circuses of the presidential elections. Oh my goodness, I can't even stand to watch it anymore. To hear about it, I don't even look at that stuff anymore. While we're inundated with this drama or this crisis or that crisis, can we take a step back? Start focusing on some fundamentals. Pull out the owner's manual and start breaking down the issues so we can start fixing the problems. What do you say? Can we go back to liberty over security, principle over party, truth over our favorite personalities? Can we get back to some real constitutional truths and education? Our children are worth it, and it's our only hope for the future. Don't forget, Elizabeth joins us this week. God bless. See you tomorrow. Get in our way.